I put it to Jim that many religious people wonder how atheists answer the question, what are we for? Well, I don't think we're for anything. We're just products of evolution. You can say, gee, your life must be pretty bleak if you don't think there's a purpose. But I'm looking forward to a good lunch. Now that's vintage Jim, and the lunch was indeed good, made better by his company. Lala and I got to know him and his wife Liz quite well when they bought a house in Oxford and spent several summers in our home city. My fellow panellists on the Brains Trust varied from week to week. There was usually at least one philosopher, sometimes a historian, once a poetic novelist. I think I was the only scientist. Part of the conceit of the programme was that we were pointedly given no advance notice of the questions. The chair even made arch jokes about this, pretending to torment us with the secrecy and putting our limited reserves of spontaneous wit under pressure. The questions were things like, what is the good life? Or, what is happiness? Happiness is a mountain stream, was how one of my hapless fellow panellists began his answer. I'm sure mine was no better, if less pretentious, and it is a matter of some happiness to me that I have forgotten it. I said that I'd mentioned the two occasions where I was stitched up by outright dishonest editing of television footage. I'm actually pleased that I can point to only two such examples, because the temptation for those with a losing agenda must be great. Creationists have ignominiously lost their argument. Deception is their last recourse, and it is not surprising that my two stitch-ups were both at the hands of creationist organisations. In September 1997, I was approached by an Australian company who said they were sending a team to Europe to make a film about the controversy over evolution. Influenced, as I shall explain in the next chapter, by a conversation with Stephen Jay Gould, I had adopted a well-reasoned policy of never having debates with creationists, but this crew's pitch sounded like a bona fide attempt to document the argument without bias, so I agreed to talk to them. The crew, when they arrived at my home, turned out to be amateurishly depauperate. The woman operating the camera also asked the questions. I answered them, despite my increasing doubts as to her competence to make a film at all, and my increasing regret that I had ever allowed her into my house. But then she asked a stock question which, as everyone involved in this so-called controversy knows, is a dead giveaway. Only a dyed-in-the-wool creationist would ever say something like, Professor Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome? It was now obvious that she had gained entry to my house under false pretences. She was, quite simply and obviously, a fundamentalist creationist, and I had been duped into granting her the attention such people crave and the opportunity to twist my words to her own balmy agenda. What should I do? Should I summarily throw her out, or answer the question straight as if I hadn't rumbled her, or something in between? I paused, trying to decide what to do. Finally, after 11 seconds trying to make up my mind, I decided to throw her out because of the dishonesty of her original approach. I told her to stop the camera, and we repaired to my study where, in the presence of my assistant, I explained that I had detected her deception and she must leave forthwith. She pleaded with me, saying she had travelled all the way from Australia to see me, an obvious lie, but let that pass. Finally, after much begging from her, I relented and agreed to resume filming. My intention was to give her a brief tutorial in some aspects of evolutionary theory, of which she was obviously completely ignorant, rather than answer her silly questions, and certainly rather than attempt to explain information theory to someone incapable of understanding it. If you are interested in a full answer to her actual question, it is in A Devil's Chaplain, the chapter called The Information Challenge, which also gives a reference to Barry Williams' account in the Australian Skeptic magazine of the whole farcical episode. Eventually she left, and I thought no more about the encounter until a year or so later when somebody called my attention to the film which had by then been released. It turned out that my 11-second pause while I was deciding whether to throw her out was represented as me being stumped by the question. She had edited the film so that the pause was followed by a cut to me talking about something completely different from a different part of the interview, which made it look as though, in desperation after being stumped, I had wantonly changed the subject. As an amusing coda, she actually produced a second version of the film, in which the information question was put not by her, but by a male accomplice, in a bare, unfurnished room, presumably in Australia, very different from the one in which I was filmed. This was probably because the sound quality of her original question, she being behind the camera, was poor. It makes the deceptive editing even more obvious, but there apparently exists no level of obviousness sufficient to penetrate the intelligence of a certain type of creationist, and they have no doubt been triumphantly dining out ever since on how I was stumped. My second stitch-up was more serious because it was perpetrated by a proper film company with professional production values, albeit also with the same apparent level of dishonesty as the Australian amateurs. Again, the initial approach, in 2007, promised an objective look at the world of creationist apologetics, with no hint that the purpose was actually creationist propaganda. Indeed, so persuaded was I of the filmmaker's intentions, I even went out of my way to help him find a venue for the filming in London. Other evolutionists, including Michael Roos and P.Z. Myers, confirmed that they were misled in a similar way. I still had no inkling of the film's agenda, even right through the interview. The interviewer asked me whether I could conceive of any possible circumstances in which life on Earth might have been intelligently designed. My honest answer was a bending over backwards to try to imagine such possible circumstances. I said that the only way I could imagine it would be seeding by aliens from outer space, and that is something I do not believe. It was my way, in other words, of saying that I did not believe life on Earth was intelligently designed. With hindsight, I should have guessed how easy it would be to twist. I still see frequent tweets and blogs saying things like, "Dawkins, the man who doesn't believe in God but believes in little green men." However, the distortion of what I said is actually small beer compared to the rest of the film. My colleague Michael Roos was stitched up in an analogous way, exploiting his own sincerity as an honest educator and twisting it to a dishonest agenda. The film even went so far as to blame Darwin for Hitler. It's doubtful that Hitler ever read Darwin, whose name does not appear even once in Mein Kampf. Actually, my bending over backwards was even more generous than the interviewer or his duplicitous producer realised. Apologists for intelligent design make no bones about who the designer is when they are talking to the faithful, the God of the Jewish Christian Bible, of course. However, there are times when they try to pretend that their case is a purely scientific one, which would work just as well if the designer were an alien from outer space. In America, they need to put it that way in order not to fall foul of the US constitutional separation between church and state when they try to argue for intelligent design being taught in science classes. When the interviewer asked me if I could imagine any conceivable circumstances under which life on this planet might have been intelligently designed, my mentioning of aliens was a conscious and deliberate bending over backwards to be more than fair to the apologists whom, little did I know, he was supporting. I've probably been fortunate in having experienced only two such episodes of outright dishonesty, and I don't want to make too much of what were, after all, rare occurrences among literally hundreds of television interviews over many years. Even so, such dishonesty has a disproportionately malign effect in that it undermines one's natural impulse to trust people, a benign impulse the loss of which makes life the poorer. As a very different example of the same kind of thing, Lala and I were once deceived by a young woman, a tutorial student of mine, into believing she was mortally ill with cancer. It eventually turned out that the only thing wrong with her was a version of Munchausen syndrome, the strange mental disorder whose sufferers feign illness. But before this was discovered, Lala had spent many hours sitting with her in hospital, holding her hand while she underwent painful tests. As soon as the doctors rumbled her, she instantly refused to see Lala ever again, presumably out of embarrassment. We never discovered how many of her other stories were also lies, for instance, her claim to be a professional trumpet player. We both agreed that the worst aspect of this episode was the way it undermined our natural human kindness and desire to help disadvantaged people. Fortunately, the undermining was only temporary, and Lala continues to this day to devote a sizable majority of her waking hours to unpaid and highly skilled charitable work. Channel 4 again. After Break the Science Barrier in 1996, I didn't get back into presenting full-length television documentaries until 10 years later, when I began my long and fruitful association with the independent producer-director, Russell Barnes. Russell and I have worked together now on 11 hours of documentary television spread over 5 different programmes on Channel 4. The first of these was about religion, broadcast in 2006 under the title Root of All Evil. The question mark was Channel 4's sole concession to my distaste for the title. No single thing is the root of all evil, although religion, when it hits its stride, makes a pretty good go of it. The budget of the film must have been quite generous because our entire crew travelled to America and also to Jerusalem and Lourdes. Lourdes served as a gently mocked monument to human gullibility, a gullibility born perhaps of desperation among the unwell. Lala told me of her first visit to Lourdes many years earlier in the company of the actor Malcolm McDowell, star of films such as If and A Clockwork Orange. They stopped their car at the top of the hill in Lourdes, and Malcolm ran wildly all the way down, shouting at the top of his voice, "I can walk! I can walk! I can walk!" Did the pilgrims take it in their stride as yet another miracle, such as their faith and hope had led them to expect? Russell encouraged me, when interviewing the Lourdes pilgrims, to hide my scepticism and just let them talk. I also interviewed a resident Catholic priest. He appeared not to believe in miraculous cures himself, but, and this is so typical of the religious mind, he didn't seem to care whether they were real or not. It was enough that the pilgrims believed they might be cured, and that this gave them comfort. For him, the real miracle was the pilgrims' faith. For me, a real miracle would have to include a cure, if not the regrowth of an amputated limb, and, as I pointed out, to his complete lack of consternation, the statistical cure rate at Lourdes is no more than would be expected by chance. In all our films, Russell encouraged me to remain quietly polite when interviewing creationists and the like. It amounts to giving them the rope to hang themselves. I tested the method almost to destruction in a later film made with Russell, The Genius of Charles Darwin, for which I interviewed Wendy Wright, president of Concerned Women for America, as an influential creationist. Her repeated refrain of, "Show me the evidence, show me the evidence, show me the evidence," in the teeth of, clear and overwhelming evidence, has become legendary on the internet. And so, it has to be said, has my patience in the fake smiling face of her. I take no credit for it. I was simply following the director's instructions and fighting down my more natural and less gentlemanly impulses. It was even harder to fight them down in some of the interviews for Root of All Evil, which exposed me to actively unpleasant individuals, the snarl-smiling Ted Haggard, for example. We concentrated most of our American filming in Colorado Springs because it has become a hotbed of Christian revivalism, while the Garden of the Gods in the foothills of the Rockies just outside the town provided some magnificent backdrops for filming pieces to camera, for example on the metaphor of Mount Improbable. Whole areas of new and surprisingly for America dull housing in Colorado Springs have become de facto fundamentalist ghettos, and we went to one of them to film a decent but naive young family who were loyal regulars in Pastor Ted's vast congregation. Ted Haggard was a small man in a big church, was, because he has since fallen from grace in a way that I won't spell out because I don't do schadenfreude. We watched in amazement as his sheep flocked into the gigantic car park in their sedans and pickup trucks, clutching their Bibles or prayer books. We listened in even greater amazement to the huge amplifiers booming out God rock while the people jigged up and down the aisles with both arms raised to heaven and beatific expressions on their faith-doped faces. Finally, Pastor Ted himself strutted his entrance onto the stage, grinning wolfishly and encouraging the 14,000-strong congregation to intone the word obedience in docile chorus. Obedience! After the service, he gave me the full arm-around-the-shoulder greeting as we started our interview. He seemed mildly flattered when I compared his service to a Nuremberg rally of which Dr. Goebbels might have been proud. But to be fair to him, it seems possible he had never heard of Nuremberg, or indeed Joseph Goebbels. Things didn't turn nasty until I questioned his understanding of evolution. But however nasty they turned, nothing could shake the carnassial grin. Later, our gifted cameraman Tim Cragg and I were packing up the kit after Tim had taken a few final shots in the car park, when a pickup truck drove up fast and slammed to a halt just short of hitting us. Pastor Ted was at the wheel, and he was furious, far more so than during the interview. With hindsight, we guessed that he probably went straight from the interview to Google my name and discovered who I was. At any rate, he berated us for abusing his hospitality, calling particular attention to his generosity in giving us tea with milk. He stressed the milk twice. And then, weirdest of all, he said to me in accusatory tones, "You called my children animals!" I was too baffled to reply. Afterwards, the crew and I discussed what it might possibly mean. The consensus was that although I hadn't explicitly mentioned either animals or the haggard children, it would be implicit in the mind of a creationist that any evolutionist must regard all humans as animals. Correctly as it happens, although why Pastor Ted chose to mention his own children rather than the entire human race was as puzzling as his homing in on milk in the tea. Perhaps he didn't mean his own biological children, but his church-going flock, doped up on childlike obedience. Who can tell? While ordering us off his land, Haggard threatened, among other things, to seize our film footage, a threat which our crew took seriously enough to carry it with us when we went out to dinner that evening, rather than leave it in Tim's hotel room. That sounds paranoid now, but Colorado Springs is such a hotbed of fundamentalist religion, and Pastor Ted's obedient congregation so enormous, it was perhaps not totally unrealistic to think there was a risk. Also in Colorado, I interviewed Michael Bray, another clergyman. Although I'm not sure how much that means in America, the title Reverend seems to be something you can acquire with a bare minimum of effort, complete with tax breaks and unearned prestige, without a qualification in theology or indeed anything else. I myself am a minister of the Universal Life Church. My certificate of ordination, which hangs in the downstairs lavatory, was bought for me as a joke birthday present by Yan Wong. Lawrence Krauss is a minister in the same church, and he has actually used the qualification to perform a marriage ceremony which he and the couple concerned are assured is legal. Bray had been in jail for violent attacks on doctors who carried out abortions, and I questioned him about his attitude and that of his friend Paul Hill, another reverend, who had been executed in Florida for murdering an abortion doctor. I got the impression both men were sincere, honestly believing in the righteousness of their cause. Indeed, among Hill's last words were that he expected a great reward in heaven, a chilling example of Steven Weinberg's much-quoted dictum, "With or without religion, good people can behave well, and bad people can do evil. But for good people to do evil, that takes religion." And indeed, I suppose if you really do think a fetus is a baby, as these people sincerely seem to do, you can put together some kind of moral case for taking the law into your own hands. At any rate, I couldn't find it in me to dislike Michael Bray the way I disliked Ted Haggard. I wished I could have found a way to talk some sense into him, but there wasn't time. Weirdly, he wanted to have a photograph taken of himself with me. I didn't know for what purpose, and I'm afraid I declined. One can make a similarly sympathetic case for Pastor Keenan Roberts, another of my Colorado interviewees, although he was a less appealing character. He ran an institution called Hell House, devoted to performing short plays designed to scare children out of their wits, with threats of being barbecued for all eternity. We filmed rehearsals of two of these playlets. The lead character of both was a sadistically roaring Satan, noisily gloating in the ha-ha manner of a Victorian melodrama baronet, over the eternal torments prepared for various sinners, a woman having an abortion in one play, a pair of lesbian lovers in the other. Afterwards, I interviewed Pastor Roberts. He told me his target audience was 12-year-olds. I bridled at this and questioned the morality of threatening children with everlasting torture. His defence was robust. Hell is such a terrible place that any measures to dissuade people, even or maybe especially children, from going there are justified. He had no answer to my question as to why he worshipped a god capable of sending children to hell, or why he believed in hell at all. It was simply his faith, and I had no entitlement to question his faith. As with Michael Bray, I could kind of see where he was coming from. If you really do believe literally in hell, if you really do think abortion is murder, and if you really do think people will roast in hell forever if they fall in love with a member of their own sex, I suppose you could say that any preventive measures, however illegal or however cruel, are the lesser of evils. Indeed, from that point of view, it's hard to see how any sincere believer could do anything but evangelize to try to save people from such a terrible fate. A bit like pulling people back from falling over a cliff. You'd feel bound to do it, even if you had to be pretty rough about it. Another example of Weinberg's dictum. I could find no such justification, however, not even a partial justification, for Joseph Cohen, alias Yusuf al-Khattab. Russell and I and the crew were in Jerusalem, trying to get to grips with the religious enmities that plague this ancient city. We spoke to a pleasantly cultivated, educated Jewish spokesman, and we spoke to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who used our local fixer as interpreter. Seeking a middle way, somebody who could see both points of view, what could seem a more natural choice than a Jewish settler who had converted to Islam, Yusuf al-Khattab, the former Joseph Cohen from New York? Surely he was in the best possible position to see both sides. How wrong we were. We found him in his small shop in a Jerusalem back street, selling perfumes. He greeted me cordially enough, but as soon as the camera was switched on, so was the vitriol, a vitriol heated up by the authentic zeal of the convert. Having been a Jew, his most passionate hatred was reserved for the Jews. He openly expressed his admiration for Hitler. He longed for world domination secured by the victorious soldiers of Allah. He refused to condemn the 9/11 raids. He attacked me as in some warped way responsible for Western decadence, reserving his especial disgust for the way you dress your women. I momentarily let my anger show through as I made the obvious retort. I don't dress women, they dress themselves. In most of my films with Russell Barnes, we have worked with the same cameraman, Tim Cragg, and the same sound man, Adam Prescod. Tim and Adam have worked together as a team on many more films all around the world, often with Russell. I've come to value friendship with all three men, the kind of camaraderie that comes from working together day after day, travelling together, eating together, laughing together at the same absurdities, even getting thrown out of the same megachurch car park together. Tim is a handsome, smiling fellow, so dedicated to his craft that he never really stops looking at the world through an imaginary viewfinder, or a real one, constantly seeking interesting, rewarding camera angles. Russell would happily send Tim off to get useful background footage on his own, knowing that he had no need of a director. Adam is similarly dedicated to and similarly good at his craft of sound recordist. He and Tim make a great team, knowing each other's game like doubles tennis partners. Someone we interviewed took one look at Adam's dreadlocks and dark skin and started asking him about reggae music, a classic case of judging a book by its cover, as Adam himself jovially observed to me. Whenever I heard him humming to himself, it was more likely to be J.S. Bach's Suites for Unaccompanied Cello. As for Russell himself, he has the same virtues as a documentary director that I first identified in Jeremy Taylor. The best directors, such as Jeremy and Russell, are like academic scholars in that they become true experts in the subject of their current documentary, reading up the original research literature and visiting and talking to experts. Then, having planned their film, shot it and edited it, they switch to another subject and start reading up all over again. Does this chameleon-like switching make for a more satisfyingly varied life than that of the academic which it superficially resembles? I could readily imagine so. For later films, I also enjoyed working with Russell's business partner and fellow director, Molly Milton. Preternaturally cheerful and friendly, she would charm her way through any barriers and breeze our whole crew through any red tape, come what might. Her Pollyanna-ish ways beguiled me too, but occasionally with mixed feelings. For the film Sex, Death and the Meaning of Life, she telephoned to ask me to go to India to interview the Dalai Lama. I was convinced, as it turned out rightly, that the great spiritual leader would be much too busy to talk to me, and I used this as my de facto method of saying no to Molly. Ha ha ha, well, if you succeed in booking the Dalai Lama, ha ha ha, I'll go to India with you, ha ha ha. I assumed that my laughing challenge was equivalent to a no, put the phone down, and thought no more of it. About 3 weeks later, Molly telephoned in high excitement. He's agreed, he's agreed, he's agreed, we can go to India. You promised you'd go if I booked the Dalai Lama. He said yes, he said yes, he said yes, we're off to India, we're off to see the Dalai Lama. Well, I could not but deliver on my earlier promise. We went to India, and then, when we got there, it turned out that, exactly as I'd guessed from the outset, the Dalai Lama was much too busy to see us. The full story then emerged. His office had said, well, if you were to turn up on such and such a day, he might possibly be able to see you, but we can't guarantee it. I believe that Molly, with her Pollyannitas ear and conviction that there's no obstacle she can't get round, literally hears, well, maybe, as yes, definitely. I forgave her. You couldn't fail to forgive somebody so winsomely charming. And we did end up filming some amazing scenes in India while we were there. Molly and I share an embarrassing secret, embarrassing for me, not her, and I hereby confess it. Again, it was sex, death, and the meaning of life, and we were filming on the top of Beachy Head on the south coast of England. Its dizzying 500-foot chalk cliffs have made it a notorious suicide spot, and there are little low crosses only knee-high lining the cliff path to commemorate the poor, agonised souls who had launched despairingly into the void. I was to take a poignant walk along the path while the camera focused in close-up on my feet as they passed the little crosses, each in their sad turn. I couldn't understand why my feet felt so uncomfortable, but I soldiered on while we shot several takes. When we finally had enough footage, I was able to sit down on the grass and take my shoes off. Blessed relief. Molly came and sat with me to plan the next scene. It was then that we noticed why my feet had been so uncomfortable. I had somehow managed to put my left and right shoes on the wrong feet. Molly giggled delightedly, and we agreed not to tell Russell and the rest of the crew. But my faux pas is preserved for posterity in close-up. I suppose I should be thankful my pas wasn't even more faux, given our proximity to the cliff edge. I am proud of all the films I made with Russell and his crew. Between Root of All Evil, the first one, and Sex, Death and the Meaning of Life, the most recent, we did Enemies of Reason, about astrology, homeopathy, dowsing, angels, and other superstitious nonsense excluding religion, The Genius of Charles Darwin, and Faith School's Menace. The last of these included a memorable trip to Belfast to examine the educational roots of the tribal wars there, and we took in an orange parade among other disquieting sights, including the huge, starkly realistic murals depicting masked men with guns. Enemies of Reason contained a telling sequence on dowsing, coordinated by the London University psychologist Dr. Chris French. Professional and amateur water diviners converged from far and wide to show their prowess, confident in their ability, proved to their own satisfaction over the years. Alas, they had never before been subjected to a double-blind trial. Inside a big tent, Chris French laid out a rectangular array of buckets. Some of the buckets contained water, some contained sand. In a preliminary trial, the lids were removed from the buckets, and the dowsers all had no difficulty. Their divining rods, hazel twigs or pieces of bent wire all obediently twitched when they could see water and didn't when they couldn't. But then came the real test, with lids on the buckets. Because it was a double-blind trial, neither the dowser nor Dr. French, who was keeping score, knew which buckets contained water. The accomplice who set them up did so with the tent sealed, and he then disappeared, so that he couldn't give the game away by any subtle cues. Under these double-blind conditions, not a single one of the dowsers scored above chance level. They were flabbergasted, desperately, in one case tearfully disappointed, and obviously sincere. Such failure had never happened to them before, but they had never done a double-blind trial before. I don't know who invented the double-blind trial, but it is a brilliantly effective yet simple technique. There's a telling story in John Diamond's courageous book Snake Oil, written when he was dying of cancer and beset by well-meaning quacks. The sceptical investigator Ray Hyman once did a double-blind trial of an alternative diagnostic technique called kinesiology. As it happens, I have experienced kinesiology myself. I'd ricked my neck and was in pain. It was the weekend, and I couldn't go to my normal doctor, so I decided to be open-minded and try an alternative practitioner. Before beginning her manipulation, she did a diagnostic test, which consisted of pushing against my arm to test my strength while I was lying on my back, kinesiology. She demonstrated to her own satisfaction that my arm was stronger, when I had a small vial of vitamin C resting on my chest. The vial was sealed, there was no way for the vitamin to enter my body, so it was obvious that she was really, though probably unconsciously, pressing harder against my arm when the vial was not there than when it was. When I expressed my scepticism, she gushed her enthusiasm. Yes, C is a marvellous vitamin, isn't it? Self-deception of that kind is precisely what the double-blind technique was invented to eliminate. In testing the efficacy of any medicine, not only must it be compared with the placebo control, it is vitally important that neither the patient, nor the experimenter, nor the nurse administering the dose should know which is experimental, which control. Ray Hyman did a double-blind trial on a slightly less far-fetched claim of kinesiology than used by my quack, that a drop of fructose placed on the tongue would strengthen a patient's arm when compared with a drop of glucose. Under double-blind conditions, there was no difference in strength. Whereat the chief kinesiologist delivered himself of this immortally indignant remark. You see, that's why we never do double-blind testing anymore. It never works. In addition to the superseding of costly film stock by digital recording, other things have changed since my early films with Jeremy Taylor. In the 1980s, film crews were heavily unionised. There were statutory times for tea breaks, lunch breaks, and the easeful it's-a-wrap moment at the end of a day's work. If Jeremy wanted his camera crews to go on a bit late in the evening because the filming was going so well and the light was so good, he had to ask them as a special favour. By the 2000s, things had changed. There somehow seemed to be a greater sense of personal involvement in the film by the entire crew, and everybody was happy to go on as long as necessary. I suspect, too, that there was a certain amount of overmanning in the 1980s. The crews back then consisted of not only a cameraman, sound man, and production assistant, but also an assistant cameraman, or focus puller, and at least one Sparks, electrician, to deal with the lights. I recall going up to Leeds around then for an ITV television show produced by Duncan Dallas, who incidentally and irrelevantly had been my exact contemporary at Balliol College, Oxford, though we hardly knew each other. Duncan and I were alone in the studio, the crew had gone off for tea, and there was a large box obstructing the space where we were trying to work. Thinking I was being helpful, I was just about to pick it up when Duncan shouted in a panic, "Don't touch it!" I recoiled as if he'd said it was a bomb, and he explained. Moving boxes was strictly the job of the scene shifters, and he couldn't answer for the consequences if I was seen picking it up. Duncan hesitated for a moment, looked nervously over his shoulder, and then whispered, "Damn it, let's risk it." And we hastily moved the box before the crew came back from their tea break. While working on this book, I was sad to read in the newspaper that Duncan Dallas had died. In addition to his television work, he was the founder of the network of Café Scientifique, an excellent grassroots organisation for bringing science to a wide public, which has spread from his hometown of Leeds to the whole country and beyond. Manchester Television Conference. In November 2006, I was invited to give a guest lecture in Manchester to a conference of science documentary makers. The title they gave me was Can Television Rescue Science in an Age of Unreason? My lecture was illustrated with clips from recent television documentaries put together with the help of Simon Berthon, who also advised on the content of the lecture. I began by apologising for presuming to lecture professionals on how to do their job. My only excuse was that I had been invited to do so. I structured my lecture around a list of 10 difficult choices, or 10 sliding scales along which a film might be situated, choices that face anyone who makes a science documentary. The first of the 10 was the question of dumbing down. The television producer rightly lives in dread of the remote control, knowing that within any 1 second of his precious broadcast, literally thousands of viewers may be tempted to flip idly to another channel. There is a powerful temptation to pile on the fun, to lace it with gimmicks, speeding up laboratory procedures like Charlie Chaplin, for example, to shrink the science to sound bites, whose real scientific nourishment is about as empty as a bucket of popcorn. I sympathised with the need to chase ratings, but made an unfashionable plea for elitism. Elitism as a mark of respect for the audience, rather than the patronising, indeed insulting, assumption that they need science to be dumbed down to render it accessible. The worst example of this patronising attitude that I ever came across was expressed by a participant in another conference on public understanding of science. He suggested that dumbing down might be necessary to bring minorities and women to science. Seriously, that is what he said, and no doubt it brought a warm, cosy glow to his condescending little liberal breast. In my Manchester lecture, I said, "Elitism has become a dirty word, and it is a pity. Elitism is reprehensible only when it is snobbish and exclusive. The best sort of elitism tries to expand the elite by encouraging more and more people to join it. Science is inherently interesting, and the interest will shine through without the need for sound bites, gimmicks, or dumbing down." Another of my 10 difficult choices concerned the perceived need to provide balance, something that especially afflicts the BBC because of its charter. I quoted a favourite maxim, which I think I first heard from Alan Graffen. When two opposing points of view are advocated with equal vigour, the truth doesn't necessarily lie halfway between. It is possible for one side to be simply wrong. The error shows itself in extreme form in the tendency for broadcasters to champion mavericks who have nothing going for them except that they buck the orthodox trend. The most egregious example I know was a televised hagiography of a medical researcher who claimed that the triple MMR vaccine caused autism. His evidence was thin and is widely discounted within the medical profession. Yet his story, unfortunately, had what journalists call legs, giving full vent to the facile trope of the virile young rebel played by a handsome and personable actor fighting the stuffy old guard. Terry the Pterodactyl was another of my headings. The wonderful computer graphics techniques first given prominence by Jurassic Park were soon exploited by documentary makers. But instead of letting the wonders of the reconstruction speak for themselves, the documentary succumbed to the same temptation as spoiled Jurassic Park itself, the perceived need to provide human interest. Not content with a computer-animated discussion of pterodactyls and their probable lifestyle, we are treated to a sob story about a particular individually named pterodactyl. I don't think he was actually called Terry, but the point stands. Getting lost and trying to find his family, or some such sentimental guff. Personified drama is not only superfluous, it perniciously blurs the distinction between speculation and real evidence. Speculation about the habits and social life of pterosaurs or sabretooths or australopithecines is absolutely fine, but it needs to be presented as speculation. Sabretooths might have had a social and sex life similar to lions or similar to tigers. The trouble with telling stories about individual sabretooths called Half-Tooth and the Brothers is that it forces you to plump for one theory, say the lion theory, rather than another. I quoted another film to illustrate the same tendency to let dramatic human interest override scientific truth. The BBC conceived the interesting idea of tracing the mitochondrial and Y-chromosome DNA of three particular West Indian individuals back to their roots in Africa or Europe. The point about mitochondria and Y-chromosomes is that, unlike all other chromosomes, they are not subject to the comprehensive scrambling of genetic history that is caused by chromosomal crossing over in the rest of the genome. You could travel to any particular moment in history, say the 14th of January 30,000 BC, and could theoretically locate the one individual female from whom your mitochondrial DNA comes. Your mitochondria come from only her and literally nobody else at that time except one and only one of her daughters, granddaughters, etc., plus her mother, her maternal grandmother, etc. If you are male, your Y chromosome comes from only one male alive in 30,000 BC, plus his father, paternal grandfather, etc., and only one of his sons, grandsons, etc. All your other DNA comes from thousands of individuals, probably scattered all over the world. So, great idea to take three people and trace the origins of the only two unmixed portions of their genomes, their mitochondria and Y chromosomes. But the producers were not content with the scientific fascination of this quest. No, they had to ham it up. And in doing so, they sadly misled those people into baseless sentimentality when they transported them back to their homeland. When Mark, later given the tribal name Kaigama, visited the Kanuri tribe in Niger, he believed he was returning to the land of his people. Beulah was welcomed as a long-lost daughter by 8 women of the Bubi tribe on an island off the coast of Guinea, whose mitochondria matched hers. Beulah said, "It was like blood touching blood. It was like family. I was just crying. My eyes were just filled with tears. My heart was pounding." She should never have been deceived into thinking this. All that she or Mark were really visiting, at least as far as they were given any reason to suppose, was individuals who shared their mitochondria. As a matter of fact, Mark had already been told that his Y chromosome came from Europe, which upset him, and he was later palpably relieved to discover respectable African roots for his mitochondria. All the rest of their genes came from a wide variety of places, probably throughout the world. A personal anecdote about Y chromosomes at this point. In 2013, I was delighted to receive an email from James Dawkins, a young historian doing a PhD at University College London, whose father's family came from Jamaica. His doctoral thesis is about the estates of a particular family of landed gentry in England and Jamaica. The family concerned is the Dawkins family, who were sugar planters in Jamaica in the 17th and 18th centuries, and I'm sorry to say, slave owners. My regrettable family history means that Dawkins is a common family name in Jamaica, not just because of a droit de seigneur, but because the family gave its name to various places in our region of Jamaica. My 6 great uncle James Dawkins, 1696 to 1766, actually had the nickname Jamaica Dawkins, as I learned from Boswell's Life of Johnson. "I have not observed," said he, "that men of very large fortunes enjoy anything extraordinary that makes happiness. What has the Duke of Bedford? What has the Duke of Devonshire? The only great instance that I have ever known of the enjoyment of wealth was that of Jamaica Dawkins, who, going to visit Palmyra, and hearing that the way was infested by robbers, hired a troop of Turkish horse to guard him." Uncle James's family wealth was squandered long ago on futile lawsuits by the paranoid Colonel William Dawkins, 1825 to 1914, who eventually died in penurious bankruptcy, and the once substantial family estates are now reduced to a small working farm in Oxfordshire. The modern James Dawkins has come several times to stay there as a welcome guest of my sister's family while researching old tin boxes filled with dusty documents in my mother's attic. We were all hopeful that he might turn out to be a long-lost cousin, and the obvious way to find out was to look at our Y chromosomes. The Oxford geneticist Brian Sykes, author of The 7 Daughters of Eve, kindly agreed to do the analysis, and both James and I sent cheek swabs to his company, Oxford Ancestors. When my result arrived, I wrote as a biologist to James as a historian, telling him what to look for in his. "We each have a Y chromosome which is nearly identical to our father and brothers. But, as the generations go by, occasional mutations arise. So, although your Y chromosome is nearly identical to your paternal grandfather's, there is a slightly greater chance of a difference than in the case of your father. If we are both descended in the paternal line from a 16th century Dawkins in Jamaica, our Y chromosomes will be nearly, but not quite, identical. It's logically necessary that if you go back sufficiently far, every human Y chromosome in the world is descended from one ancestor who was whimsically named Y chromosome Adam. He almost certainly lived in Africa, probably between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago. If you look at all the Y chromosomes in the world, they're all descended from Y Adam. But because of geographical separation and migrations, etc., they can be classified into a dozen or so major clans. Each of these clans can be traced to a hypothetical ancestor, a particular man who lived in a particular place. Brian Sykes has given them all fanciful names. For example, my Y chromosome is derived from Oisin, who lived in West Eurasia. That would be true of most Englishmen, and doesn't mean we are close cousins. However, if it should turn out that your Y chromosome is also descended from Oisin, that would be extremely interesting. Of course, it might only mean that it came from a West European. But then the coincidence of surnames kicks in, and it would mean it would be worthwhile looking in more detail to see if our Y chromosomes are closer than any 2 West European Y chromosomes. If, on the other hand, your Y chromosome came from one of the 3 African progenitors coloured red on the rather pretty tree diagram, that would mean there's no point in our pursuing genetic cousinship any further, which would be a pity. When James's results came in, it turned out that we are not cousins descended from the same Dawkins ancestor. A pity indeed. James's Y chromosome is derived not from the male tagged Oisin by Brian Sykes, but from Eshu, who lived in Africa. I've reproduced in the E-appendix Brian's pedigree of all the human Y chromosomes. James's and my faces are superimposed alongside our respected ancestors, African Eshu and West European Oisin, the names given them by Brian Sykes. You can see that our cousinship is actually rather distant. Well, strictly speaking, what you can see is only that our Y cousinship is not close. We could share a more recent ancestor down a female line. But it does mean that our shared surname has no direct genetic significance of the kind that J.B.S. Haldane was referring to when he said, "I was born with a historically labelled Y chromosome," meaning an ancient surname. It's an interesting thought that aristocratic and royal families, who can trace their male lines back over centuries, are now in a position to question the legitimacy of each link in the chain simply by looking at the Y chromosomes of their alleged cousins in the male line. Will courts of law soon be asked by long-forgotten distant cousins to examine DNA challenges by pretenders to thrones or ducal houses? Back to my presumptuous lecture to the science documentary makers. I included a brief section called Science as Poetry or Science as Useful. Nobody could deny the usefulness of science, frequently cited in terms of the myth that the space program was justified by the spin-off of the non-stick frying pan, but I was keen to advocate the Carl Sagan, visionary or poetic end of the spectrum, rather than the non-stick frying pan end. As I put it on an earlier occasion, concentrating only on the usefulness of science is a bit like celebrating music because it's good exercise for the violinist's right arm. One of my final sallies was an attack on the conventional wisdom among TV professionals that people don't want to watch talking heads. I had no data to support my scepticism, but I remember the huge success of John Freeman's Face-to-Face series on BBC TV, in which even the interviewer's face was not seen, only the back of his head and one shoulder from behind. All the concentration was on the face, and of course the words, of the interviewee. The series has become legendary. Subjects included Bertrand Russell, Edith Sitwell, Adlai Stevenson, C.G. Jung, Tony Hancock, Henry Moore, Evelyn Waugh, Otto Klemperer, Augustus John, Simone Signore, and Jomo Kenyatta. I was interviewed by the wittily articulate sociologist Laurie Taylor in a recent revival of the show. On a smaller scale, my Mutual Tutorial videos have been well received, and they are nothing but talking heads. Nearly a decade before that Manchester conference, in fact, I'd been lucky enough to take part in a project that used the talking heads format to maximum effect. In the spring of 1997, I was approached by Graham Massey, sometime head of BBC Science and a previous BBC Horizon producer. He had had a lovely idea inspired by his friend Christopher Sykes's celebrated interview with the great physicist Richard Feynman. He wanted to make a video archive of distinguished scientists talking at length about their careers. The format was to be an interview of each individual by a younger scientist who knew the field well enough to draw them out. The point was not to make programmes for immediate broadcasting, but to compile a record for the future, something that would survive perhaps for a very long time and be of interest to historians of science in later generations. I loved the idea and consequently felt hugely honoured to be invited to be the interviewer of John Maynard Smith. The interview took place over 2 days in John's house in Lewes in Sussex. John and his wife Sheila invited me to stay the night, and we all, including Graham and the crew, had lunch on both days in the local pub. The 2 days of conversation were divided into 102 stories, each lasting a few minutes. Each story had its own title and can be separately viewed, although they form a definite sequence, and if watched sequentially, form a wonderfully absorbing picture of the great man's scientific life. They include autobiographical accounts of his early life, education at Eton, wartime employment as an engineer designing aeroplanes, Marxist politics at Cambridge, and returning to university as a mature student after the war to read biology. Some of the later stories uncover John's occasionally strained relations with Bill Hamilton. John told the story with disarming frankness. Neither he nor his famously idiosyncratic mentor, the great J.B.S. Haldane, recognised that the shy young man, working in another department of their university, was a consummate genius. John quoted Huxley on closing The Origin of Species, how extremely stupid of me not to have thought of that. He reproached himself for not having offered support to Hamilton when the younger man needed it. In subsequent stories, he compared Bill Hamilton's concept of inclusive fitness, a measure of what an individual organism is expected to maximise, with the gene's eye view adopted by Bill in other papers, the view which I, along with John, prefer, and which eventually arrives at the same answer as the inclusive fitness approach. It was at University College London after the war that John came under the sway of J.B.S. Haldane, and the interview was peppered with lovely stories of that formidable eccentric. I'll quote one to give the flavour. He and his wife Helen had the rather nice habit, on the night when we'd all finished our finals examination, of taking the class, after the last exam, to the Marlborough, which is the pub just down the other side of the road, and buying us all a drink until closing time. It was very pleasant, and I went there the night I took finals. And when the pub shut, he said to me and to Pamela Robinson, who was also going to become a graduate student, in fact, paleontology, would we like to go back to his flat and continue drinking, because we clearly hadn't had enough. And rather foolishly we said we would. So we went back to Prof's flat, and we continued to drink and talk about the world until about 2 o'clock in the morning. Pamela said, "Look, Prof, John and I really have to go home, but the tubes have stopped running, and you're going to have to drive us home." So Haldane said, "All right, I'll drive you home." So we piled into Prof's car. It was a typical Haldane possession. It was extremely old and ramshackle and decrepit. And we started driving up Parliament Hill. And about halfway up the hill, the car started filling with smoke. And I didn't like to say anything. I thought this was normal. But Pamela said, "Prof, I think the car's on fire."
Oh, well.
So we drew up. And as an engineer, I was told to find out what was wrong. And it was clear nothing very serious was wrong. What had happened was that the carpeting had fallen down on the transmission and was burning underneath the front seat. So we looked at this for a bit, and Haldane said, "The ladies will go and stand behind yonder lamppost." I thought, what next? And he then turned to me and said, "Smith, the method of Pantagruel. You've had more beer than I have. Put it out." Now, part of this is, of course, you had to know the classical quotation. You had to know that Pantagruel had, in fact, put out Paris on fire by peeing on it. So I did. And I don't know, you know, if you've had a lot of beer and you start peeing, it's kind of hard to stop. He said, "That's enough, boy, that's enough." But my point is that if you're going to work and live with Haldane, you had to be prepared to live in this slightly unpredictable environment. And I was. The other thing about Haldane was that if he said something you disagreed with, you could tell him to shut up and stop being such a silly old fart. He didn't mind. But you had to treat him like that. It was no good being polite. You had to fight back if he said things you didn't agree with. The transcript is nice, but you really have to listen to John. He was such a wonderful raconteur. The story straight after that one reduced John to tears as he recalled the moment when Haldane, about to depart to end his days in India, had confessed his affection for John's wife, Sheila, and asked John to tell her because he was not able to do so himself. The emotion, actual and recollected, is powerful and moving, and all this was done by the method of talking heads.